Welcome to the Del Walmsley Radio Show. Listen and grow as Del questions the status quo, encourages you to think differently, and empowers you to make a better life. Get ready as Del challenges core beliefs, seeks the truth, and reveals the roadmap to the lifestyle you really want. And now your host, multi-millionaire, national award-winning investor, CEO and founder of Lifestyles Unlimited, Del Walmsley.
Welcome to the Del Walmsley Radio Show, where the hype ends and the help begins. I'm your host, Del Walmsley, and as always, we're working on your financial freedom. Today, my friends, I'm going to attack two different subjects. The first one I want to cover is, when do you know you're in a dead-end job? I'm going to tell you just a few stories about mine and how these dead-end jobs drove me to look into investing. Then I'm going to cover, how do you choose all these different investments out there and which one's right for you and wrong for you and what works and what doesn't work? And then I'm going to take you through my progression. I don't know how far along I can get in this whole conversation, but, you know, from single family to small multifamily to medium-sized multifamily to large multifamily, syndications and so forth. I don't know if I can get all that in, probably not. But I do want to cover like this progression. I want you to go through this with me psychologically because I think it's important. So the story starts back when I got out of college. I quit college when I was, I think, a junior. I figured out that I really didn't need college to make millions of dollars, that what they were teaching me in college didn't seem like it was going to play out well unless you just wanted to get a job and sit in a cubicle. And really what I thought they were training you in college to do was to learn how to be a cubicle person or learn how to get along and be along with a part of a company. And I thought, well, you know, I can do that. I can do that on my own, and I don't really need all this college education for that, although I did take college for 3 years. I don't know if I really got much out of it. I mean, I got information. There was education in there. But really what I saw most people were doing there was it was a place to stick your kids that hadn't grown up yet. And it was that one more step where you first got out of the house and had some place to go that you didn't go home every single night to your parents, whether you lived on campus or you lived in a dorm. You know, if you lived in a dorm on campus or if you lived in an apartment or wherever you did, it was kind of like that opportunity, you know, and maybe the first year or two you lived at home and you took the bus to college every day or. Because I lived in Madison, Wisconsin, where you could literally go to college and live in your parents' home. Or you could live on site. And so I saw kids that were going through this maturation process. And I think if you've got kids, and I have kids, that you see them going through this process. I see them very far behind where we were now because I see kids that are 28 years, 30 years of age, 34 years, that are still just like we were when we were in college. Just the kids were just crazy. I mean, they didn't really know what to do. They had no idea how the world works. You literally go out there right now and interview kids. They have no idea about how the world truly works, both business-wise, political-wise, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, health and fitness-wise. They think they know everything. They know nothing. It's amazing how little they actually know about the world. And you would think with all this easy access to, you know, the internet, and information, that they'd be brilliant. But they're only brilliant in just a very, very limited scope. The things that they focus on and the stuff they focus on, you know, it's very easy for them to go down a rabbit hole and get totally twisted and turned around as to what's really going on in the world. I run into this all the time. I talk to kids in the gym and, you know, they always come up to me and ask me about, you know, how did I get so big and why am I a bodybuilder and how did I stay in great shape up to my 70s and so forth? So there's always a conversation they want to have. I don't mind it, and I talk with them about it all the time. But it allows me to hear their ideas, and it's kind of scary. So whatever it may be, I just came to the conclusion very early on that it just wasn't going to make me a millionaire to stay in college. So I got out, and I said, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to analyze what the five fastest growing cities in the country were. I had to be where something was going on, where the growth was rapid, because I wanted to take advantage of that rapid growth and grow myself. So I did an analysis, and I came up with like Dallas, Houston, San Francisco, San Diego, and L.A. So those are the five fastest growing cities in the country. And, oh, one other caveat, they had to be in warm climates. I lived up in Madison, Wisconsin. It was freezing cold, and I said, I'm never going to live in the North again. I am never going to shovel a driveway of snow ever again in my life. I guarantee you I never will. You know, people say we should have a second home in Colorado. I go, yeah, sure. Let's visit anytime you want to visit. I'm not going to own anything where I have to shovel. I'm not going to own anything where I have to fight the snow, where I have to freeze, where my car won't start, and so on and so forth. So part of the caveat was I got to get out of there. I got to go south. Now, it's interesting because one of my staff members sent me a picture of, they live in Las Vegas, and they have a cabin up in the cliffs, up in the mountains, and it's already snowing there, and it's beautiful. Of course, it's November, shouldn't it be? It's 85, 90 degrees in Houston. And I'm thinking, gosh, it's so wonderful. And it's amazing because when people go, well, it's hot and humid, you go, yeah, I'll take hot and humid any day over freezing cold. Can't go outside, gonna die if you get caught without, you know, cover, you know, that kind of stuff. Unbelievable. So I went, that was part of the thing. So I came down here and I went to Dallas. And lo and behold, believe it or not, the day I hit Dallas was 1 in 100 years that Dallas had a snowstorm. And not only just snow, it had a snowstorm. And I said, that's it. I can't believe this. There's no way. So I didn't even give Dallas a chance. I drove right through Dallas, went right to Houston. I got to Houston. And I went down to Galveston. I said, the Galveston Bay is ugly. The water's dirty. I came from Wisconsin. The water's glacial fed. It's crystal clear. You can drink it. You can see, you know, 100 feet deep in it. It's just different. When I saw Galveston, I go, oh, my God. And I think it also was the year they had an oil spill down there or something. So it was even worse. There was like these big oil clumps all over the beach. I go, this is terrible. I'm not going to Galveston. So we went back up to Houston. And I found a place to stay. Got a little dirt bag hotel room. Pulled off. So let me just see what they have for, you know, opportunities here. And I looked in the paper for these business places where they'll find you a job. I go, let's try one of these job locator companies. And sure enough, they got me a job within just a day or two. It was amazing. It was so busy here in Houston. So they got me this job where I was a, what did they call it? A manager trainee in a finance company. Something like that. I don't even know if they're around anymore. I doubt it. But there's a lot of these little finance companies which just make small loans to families. And my job was to go in there every day and to cold call people and ask them if they wanted money. Do you need any money? We got a loan waiting for you over here. And these are previous clients that had borrowed money and paid money off. And so they had good credit with us. And we were just trying to get money out. We had to have a certain amount of money lent out for the office to work. Then after I did that in the afternoon, I spent the time collecting money for people that owed us money that were behind on their payments. My job was then to call them, cold call them, and bug them to pay the money. Okay, terrible job in both aspects. One, it did teach me how to sell and how to cold call and not be afraid to cold call. It did teach me how to collect money, which both of those things came out to be beneficial for me in the future years of my life. However, it was supposed to be a manager trainee program. It was only paying $600 a month, which is about $1.75 an hour, something like that, when you looked at the hours. It was just ridiculous. So they had this training program, and this is where I'm telling you to watch out. Whenever they say they have a manager training program, it is a scam. Almost always it's a scam. And in this one, they had this back room. You bring in the back rooms, like the lunchroom, and they had all these videotapes. I mean, she's really impressive. I mean, it was like maybe 30 or 40 boxes of videotapes, and there was a book that went with each videotape. And what you're supposed to do was take the videotape and the book home and study that until you could pass a test on it. And then, you know, you bring it back, you pass the test, you move on to the next one type of thing. Well, this, I had found out later, was typically took somewhere between 3 to 6 years for people to pass all these things to get to be a manager trainee. I did it in 6 months. You say, well, how'd you do it in 6 months? Well, let me focus on this. I lived in a bedroom. I'm renting a bedroom, not a one-bedroom apartment, but a bedroom from a guy who rented a two-bedroom apartment. I rented a bedroom from him. I had nothing to do, and I had no money to do it with, and you're only paying me $600 a month, so I couldn't afford to go out. I couldn't spend any money. I couldn't do anything. So the only thing I did was work out, and besides work out is I took these classes, trained. And so I did what was supposed to be 3 to 4 years worth of training. I did it in like 6 months, 8 months, something like that. And when I was done, I took all the classes, and I passed all the tests. I said, I said, so when do I get a store? When do I get to be a manager? They go, you don't. I said, what do you mean you don't? So you're too young. You're like in your 20s. And my manager was like 65 years old, 67, smoked every day, looked like he was going to die in any minute now. And that was the culture. It was a good old boys culture that ran these things. And, you know, they just ate up young guys and gals that were willing to come in for this manager training program and then really have nowhere for them to go. So it was a con. So I decided I was going to leave. And I left. I said, I got to go do something, make some money. And I heard about driving trucks. So I went and applied to get drive trucks. And they said, well, you have to have a truck driver's license. I said, okay, well, how do I get a truck driver's license if I don't have a semi to drive to practice? I said, well, you take all the tests, you get your learner's permit, and you become a helper. Here we go again. Now I'm a helper on a truck. So I'm doing all the work. We get there at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm loading the truck with all the dairy products. We go out and deliver all day long, and then whatever's left over, we come back, I unload the truck at probably 4 in the afternoon. Then after that, 4 or 5 in the afternoon, maybe 6, I got off, and I'd go work out. I was dead tired. I'd been out in the hot and cold because it was a refrigerated truck, and we were taking stuff into refrigerators, so it was out hot, then cold, then hot, then cold, then hot, then cold. Oh, man, this is brutal, but I saw that these guys were making thousands of dollars a week, and I go, man, this is pretty good pay the way they're getting paid. But what I found out was that these companies, and this particular company was a dairy products company here in Houston, Texas, they were stealing. And what they would do is they would load up their truck with dairy products in the morning, and then they would go to different deliveries. Some stuff was straight up. Guy would make an order. You'd bring in the order. He'd pay for you. Either pay for it on credit slip and pay the office later, or pay you cash right out of his pocket, right out of his cash register. So all the small places, little mom and pop gas stations and grocery stores and so forth, they paid cash. Well, what would happen is the truck driver would give them discounts. But what he would also do is he would take the old products out of one guy's refrigerator, load them back on the truck, give them new product, and then he would charge them full price. But then when we go to the next place where it was some, you know, foreigner guy that was trying to make a deal, and so he would make deals with these guys, and the deal was he'd, you know, sell it to them if they pay all cash for like 50 cents on the dollar. But what he was doing was giving them dated product that had come out of somebody else's refrigerator. And I sat there, I go, you can't be doing this, man. I can't even believe this. And then at the end of the day, whatever product we had left over, he would go down to the corner and just sell it. Sit out on, you know, corner in the poor part of town and say, hey, we got milk here for 10 cents a gallon, you know, whatever. And we'd sell the stuff off and he'd put money in his pocket. What was worse was many times what he would do is he would say, okay, take in a pallet of dairy products, and then when I go up front to get the guy to sign the credit report stuff, take out a pallet of his old stuff. And he'd go in there and undercount the guy's stuff and say, you only have this much in there. And the guys didn't keep inventory. Supposedly they relied on us to keep inventory. So they would count it, undercount it, and they'd pay the guy for the new product, but we'd be taking the old product out, and like I said, we'd be selling it to somebody else. So this went on about 6 months, 8 months, and I go, man, I just can't do this. I can't make a living this way. And interesting thing was, during that time, I did get my license for driving a semi. I had a commercial driver's license. I took the test. I passed the test. I parallel parked a semi, but I just couldn't do it. I go, I can't be the guy up front that's making the deals and ripping people off, because that's what the truck driver had to do. He had to be the guy that was making the deals and doing the scam, and I couldn't do it. You know, I could load the truck and be dumb in the back over there, but, you know, I needed a job. But that was it. That's all there was. And if we had a good day, the guy would tip me out really well, you know, that type of deal. Because he was just making a killing. He might be making $5,000 a day. You don't know. It was just ungodly money. Now, I did later meet a family that did this for a living. And so I found out exactly what was going on, because I dated a girl whose father was in the business for 25 years. And he sat me down and explained to me exactly how it worked. And I go, whoa. Now, this was after I'd already quit, so I wasn't in it anymore. But it was interesting to go back and see. You know, I told the guy, I said, I know this, everybody's ripping it off. He goes, well, it's even worse than that. Here's what's really going on. So on and on. I knew that was a scam. I had to get out of there. The next thing I did was I got in the health club business. And the health club business, they said, oh, here's what we'll do. We'll pay you, it was $2.75 an hour, minimum wage. and you can work in the gym, but you can sell memberships and you'll get paid a commission on each membership you sell. The problem was, if you were a lowly startup doing all the cleaning and you were working people out and you never really got to sell the memberships, the only way you got to sell a membership is if somebody bring a guest and you work them out, you could then try to sell the membership to the guest. It was just ridiculous. You couldn't make any money. I was making $2.75 an hour. But here's the part that's interesting. I didn't care. And the reason I didn't care was because I was doing what I wanted to do. I was in health club all day long. It was cool. It wasn't hot and cold, hot and cold. I wasn't lifting anything. I was working with people. It was fun. I was helping them learn how to do what I do for a living, which was be a bodybuilder. I was helping them learn how to be in shape. I enjoyed the heck out of it. So I just put up with it. But what ended up happening, one time everybody went to lunch and somebody walked in the front door. And I toured the guy and I sat him down and said, okay, I'm going to sell you the membership. Now, these guys were selling these health club memberships in a scam way. They have you put $50 down and sign a contract for life. You're paying $30 a month for the rest of your darn life almost. It was 3 years, 36 months. And I was not afraid of contracts because I'd worked in this finance company. I had no fear of contracts whatsoever, how to fill them out, how to sign them, whatever. But I didn't know what the finance plans were available. I just knew, you know, the membership was $500 and if I could get that. So I signed the guy up and I said, it's $500. And the guy wrote me a check for $500. I filled the contract out, paid in full, had him sign it. And when everybody came back from lunch, there was a paid in full contract, something they had never seen, never done, never in their career. And all of a sudden, I had a job as a salesman. We'll be right back with the Del Walmsley Radio Show.
Teaching you with a roadmap to creating the lifestyle you really want. Keep listening. The Del Walmsley Radio Show returns in moments.
Real estate investing doesn't have to be confusing. Lifestyles Unlimited teaches you how to build income with a clear plan and real-world strategy. Text radio to 88007. That's RADIO to 88007.
You're hearing the Del Walmsley Radio Show. Want more life-changing knowledge? Access our podcast and listen on demand at lifestylesunlimited.com under the radio tab. Now your host, Del Walmsley.
Welcome back to the Del Walmsley Radio Show. Today we're talking about how do you know if you've got like a dead-end job. So I'm up to like my third job after college, third or fourth. I'm not sure which one it was. But at this job, I was working in a health club, and I worked there for 12 years. And during that time, I'd stayed just because I liked doing what I was doing. But the bottom line was it came down to what you did was you made your money with a minimum wage and selling memberships. So what I found was is that the selling of membership skill set was more important than anything else, even though I knew all about fitness and working out and the whole bit, which I thought really would help me. It was really that you need to learn how to sell. So I took all kinds of sales courses and learned how to sell things and worked through it and became very good at it. And eventually they came to me and said, you know, you're one of our best. Well, they made me a sales manager immediately after I made that sale because no one had ever sold a cash membership. Everybody had to try to get $50 out of their pocket and $30 a month, get them to sign a contract. I just got the guy to give me $500 on a check. And they said, how did you do that? I said, well, I just told him it was $500 and I put enough value to it that it was worth that. And so I started teaching other people how to sell. And eventually, you know, right away they made me a salesman. Not eventually, right then they made me a sales manager in a small health club. Little teeny tiny one in the bad part of town. I did well there, won a national award. And then they moved me to larger ones, and I did well there. And eventually they wanted to make me a supervisor. Well, the supervisor game was really, there's where the scam came in. You were making more selling memberships if you were good at it in a big club, in a new club, than the supervisors made, probably double. But by making you a supervisor, you were now responsible for five or six of these clubs, and you had to have them staffed, and you had to hire and train and keep it all working and take care of the maintenance, and I mean everything. And you got paid less than you made, probably half of what I made when I was a manager. And I said, I don't want to do that. That's ridiculous. It was a ripoff. And I don't know how they ever got anybody to do it, but they did. I guess because people wanted the ego of being a supervisor, which meant you ran four or five clubs, you know, kind of your ego. I said, no, I won't do it. I said, I'm not going to take any kind of pay cut. And so what they did was I arranged for them to give me a piece of profit off of each club. I said, look, you're not making very much money in these things because you're not selling anything, because you're selling all these contracts, and you have to sell the contracts to somebody, and the contracts about, I think it was like 40% of them were canceling on them. I said, yeah, so your cancellation rate was so high that your discount rate on your contracts was so low that you weren't making any money. If you could sell cash, you could double your profitability instantly. And so they didn't believe I could do it, and they gave me the deal. They said, okay, we'll pay you off the bottom line. I killed them. I made more than the regional area partner that was making, you know, $250,000 a year type of money. All of a sudden, I was making his kind of money, and they go, whoa, we can't have this. And they reneged on the deal. But then they had learned what I knew and how to do it, and so they started teaching everybody to do that, and they did it throughout the country. 400 health clubs, they just changed everything what they did. And I said, you know, I should probably own my own business, because when I come up with something and I make it happen, I should get profit from it. But I didn't get any profit from that. All that growth all over the country and everything, I got none of it. It's like, hey, this guy became famous. And I've had that happen before when we had the Houston Apartment Association. I went there and I probably brought like 400 or 500 members of the Houston Apartment Association, and I won a little award and said, okay, go getter award. And then they gave me a lifetime award for lifetime go getter award, which was a lifetime emeritus membership to the Houston Apartment Association. But lo and behold, you might have an entire year where they don't sign up 50 people. I was signing up 100 a year by myself. So, and all this, it came to me, you know, you got to get out and do something for yourself. And so I looked at franchises. But franchises are a giant ripoff also. I looked at McDonald's. You got to pay like $100,000 or better back then. And then you had to put a part of the money and sign a loan to get the building built and the land and everything. Unless you bought somebody else's, then you had to pay him off and buy his building from him, right? And McDonald's owns the building, but you own a part of it. You had to take all these training courses to learn how to run at McDonald's way. And so it was like $250,000 to get into a McDonald's. I was like, this is ridiculous. So then I looked at like Subway Sandwich, which was a brand new franchise back then. And it was only like $35,000 to get into it. But it was basically a job. You had to go work there, because getting kids, young kids, to work there for minimum wage, if they don't show up, they don't show up. You got to work. And so I just didn't see it. Plus, the profits was only like $35,000 a year. I could make that work at the health club. So I started looking at all these different things. I started trading stocks. I bought into limited partnerships, oil wells. I did everything I could think of. Stuck my toe in every water puddle I could find to try to do stuff. And I think all of you have done this. And what I found is it just went down left and right. The oil and gas, it was actually a gas well deal I got into. It was a limited partnership, and they drill. And then all of a sudden, the price of gas went down to almost nothing. And so they said, we'll just cap them off. It's not worth even pulling the gas out of the ground. By the time the price of pulling it out of the ground, what you can sell it for, there's no profit. So sat there. The limited partnership only ran for like 7 years or something like that, 10 years, whatever it was. At the end, they go, well, we're just going to sell it off for 10 cents on the dollar. Do you want your 10 cents back? And I said, yeah, I'll take my 10 cents back. So I lost the money. As soon as I sold it, gas prices went up and they all made millions. It was a ripoff. They knew it was time to buy everybody out. They didn't try to buy you out when gas prices were down. They right at the verge of knowing gas prices were going up. I'm dumb as a rock. I don't know it. So I sell out at 10 cents on the dollar and lose everything. Day trading was great until Black Monday. You know, I was trading every day. I was making small amount of moves on large number of different trades, watching the move just a little bit, then getting out and taking my profit. And boy, I had this down pat. I thought I was really doing well. Then Black Monday came and everything went down and stayed down until after the first of the year, which meant it was already too late. I had lost a very good portion of my money. At this point, I started looking into real estate, and I told myself, after I lost a lot of money in the stock market and after I lost money in these other types of investments, I said, I don't need to give my money to somebody else now. I need to buy something myself, because I can always lose my own money. You know what I mean? If I'm going to lose my money, let it be mine. And I remember after I lost all the money in stock market, I said, I should have paid my house off. I should have bought myself a brand new car. I should have gone on a world tour. I should have done all this stuff. I would have had that experience and had that in my life now. But I just lost it. I said, I'm never again going to lose money by just giving it somebody else to take it. I'm going to own it myself. And if I lose it, then I lose it. But when I got into rental real estate, I found it was interesting because you now owned an asset. It was pretty hard to lose asset. You know, and I've done real estate for 35 plus years. I've never lost a house. I've never lost an apartment. They've never run away from home. No one's ever stolen one from me. I've never lost one. They're there. And the business may go up and down, and you know, you may have to evict a tenant now and then, and you may have something break and you have to fix it, but the asset's still there. It doesn't go anywhere. And if you buy more of them and more of them and more of them and more of them, your wealth builds. So I got up to 107 houses. It was just mind-boggling, right? And I loved houses because each one of them was nothing to do. It was simple. It wasn't scary. And you didn't have to worry about whether you had 10 or 20 other ones. You have one to worry about today. I'm going to buy one. It was simple. Buy it. It makes more money. I make more money. I have more assets. I don't know how much simpler it can get than that for somebody young. And I was young. I was in my late 20s, early 30s. I retired by the time I was 34 years old with over 107 houses. So I started my late 20s, early 30s. I don't remember exactly. It was two and a half years, I guess it was, I always claim. So whatever that would have made me, early 30s. But it's irrelevant because it's really all about you buy one, you get over your fear, you buy another one, you get over your fear, you buy another one. And then pretty soon you get cocky about it. You start buying two, three, four, five at a time. I remember I bought five duplexes all at one time. Then I bought 15 duplexes all at one time. Then I bought three fourplexes all at one time. And I started buying them in groups. And because I got to the point where I was so comfortable, it just was nothing to it. You buy it, you put a tenant in it, it makes money. And so I ran these. And what was interesting was I saw that the economics of scale of having 10 of them exactly like, 10 units exactly like right next to each other, where every color was the same, where every, you know, they use, buy one paint, it's good for all of them. One flooring, it's good for all of them. One set of locks, it's good for all of them. Every single thing was the same. So it was very repetitious. So you knew what everything cost. Everything was contained. And for the first time, it allowed me to have somebody on site, one of the tenants that lived there, watch the place for me. So I made a deal with the lady. I said, look, I'll reduce your rent or won't give you a rent increase or whatever it was. I made some kind of negotiation with the lady. I said, but what I want you to be is my eyes, my ears, my arms, my legs. I don't want to go over here. And so if anybody's got a problem, they come to you. You go over, take pictures of it, take videos of it, send it to me, and I'll decide what to do. If somebody moves out, you let me know. I don't want to find out by finding out. I want you to tell me when you see them moving out. If somebody doesn't pay the rent, I want you to go over and knock on the door and ask for the rent. And if they won't pay, then I need you to put the eviction notice on their door. Everything so I didn't have to go over there is what it basically came down to, because it was quite a distance, a 45-minute to an hour drive from where I lived. And just the idea of not having to go there. So I prearranged all the deal. I negotiated all the contracts with all the vendors. I had preordained, you know, all the units were exactly the same size. So I knew exactly how much carpet it took to replace the carpet. I knew exactly how much painting it took to paint the unit. I had a contract for mowing all the yards. Et cetera, et cetera. Everything was very uniform, very easy to deal with. And so if somebody moved out, she'd simply put a sign in the yard for rent. But this time the sign had her telephone number on it, not mine, which made all the difference in the world. Because before they would call me, and then I'd have to set up an appointment to drive 45 minutes to an hour there and meet them to show them the unit. Now they call the sign, she'd pick up the phone, and they say, yeah, well, can I see the unit? I go, yeah. When would you like to come? You want to come right now? And many people, they're that way. If I'm looking into this right now, I want to get it done right now. Yeah, I'll come over right now, or I'll be over there in an hour. Can I come this afternoon? And she would be there to be able to let them in to see the unit. And voila, there it was. A lease was done without me taking a call, without me going over there or anything. Also, when the old tenant moved out, she'd go in and assess what needed to be done, and she'd call the make-ready company and have them come in and do the make-ready. Now, at that time, I owned quite a few houses already, and so I had a maintenance man that worked for me. He drove a van and was on a pager. So a lot of the repairs and maintenance things that need to be fixed, he could do. But if it needed a paint job, we called our paint company. It'd come in 1 hour, the unit would be painted. They're all small units. They'd just get it done. If you needed new carpet, and by the way, we didn't put carpet in these. We put linoleum, so it never needed new carpet. But in later projects where we had carpet, we already had the carpeting measured and everything. So we'd have a maid. And what would happen is the maid would come in, clean it, mop the floors, wipe off all the walls, you know, with 409, you can, whatever you clean it with, try to fix the blinds, arrange everything, you know, clean the stove, whatever needed to be done. We didn't supply a refrigerator, so they had to take their fridge. If they didn't take their fridge, then we'd clean the fridge and give it to the next tenant and say, we have a move-in bonus, we'll give you this fridge. Because we didn't want to own it, because if it broke, we didn't want any responsibility for it. So we'd say to them, you know, there really isn't a fridge here. They left this one. Do you want it? And they'd say, yeah, I want it, so I'd have to buy one. Okay, that's fine. Well, then we'd have them sign a disclaimer that we're not responsible for repairing it if it breaks and so forth. So she would have that unit ready, and then she could start showing it right away because she was right there. You know, before when I wanted the vendors to come, I had to go over there and unlock the door or set up a key lock box for them somewhere. Then I had to go and make sure they did the work before I paid them. Now, they'd do the work. She'd go in and take the pictures, send them to me. I'd pay them. It was just so easy. All of a sudden, real estate had completely changed from this. It's going to take a lot of work, a lot of time, to, wow, this is easy stuff. Now, that was the beginning of me really loving real estate. The next level is when I bought a 64-unit apartment complex where I had a full-time manager. That it was their job to run the business. And I had a full-time maintenance man who was on site every day to fix stuff. At that point, there was literally almost nothing for me to do. In fact, the manager used to get mad if I even came around. She'd say, what are you here for? There's nothing you can do. And quite honestly, if I'd go deal with the tenants, then they wouldn't want to deal with her anymore. And so it became ineffective for me to deal with tenants, and she just dealt with everything. Man. The world changed. I made one phone call in the morning to the manager. All right, it's the maintenance guy there. He has everything going. We got any problems? Do we need anything? Do you need money? Et cetera. The maintenance man had a credit card that he could use, and the credit card was tracked. Every time it would be used, I had to okay it if it was above a certain amount, et cetera, et cetera. Every time he used it, I could see what he bought, where. Everything was under control, but without me doing anything. And my friends, this is the beginning of where real estate can change your life. That 64-unit apartment complex was everything. In fact, it was so incredible. I bought one right across the street for 68 units and one right down the block for 98 units. It's unbelievable. Bought another one right around the corner with 104 units and one right around the corner from there for 34 units. It just was that easy. Once you have your team in place. Well, I hope you learned something from this today and at least start thinking about, do you have one of those dead-end jobs that's going nowhere? And were you ever retired? I retired at 34 years of age, and I hope you will someday too. Because remember, it's not just the money. It's the lifestyle. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you tomorrow.
Listening to the Del Walmsley Radio Show. Want more of Del's unconventional wisdom? Go to lifestylesunlimited.com and click the radio tab. Listen to past shows, hear podcasts on demand, and find out how you can change your life today. The Del Walmsley Radio Show is part of the Lifestyles Unlimited Radio Network.
The information and opinions you hear on the Del Walmsley Radio Show are those of the host, Del Walmsley, his guests, and his callers, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of this station, its affiliates, its management, or advertisers. The Del Walmsley Show is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult a professional regarding your personal investment needs. Nothing presented on the Del Walmsley Show constitutes an endorsement, recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or security.